IVM.
Hi, I'm Satyajit.
Hi, I'm Rachita.
Welcome to Paperback by the Open Library Project.
We have as our guest today Sonali Gupta. Sonali is a clinical psychologist and the author of the book Anxiety, which we discuss in the first half of the podcast.
In the second half, we discuss In the Company of Men by Eileen Scully, I Never Promised You a Rose Garden by Joanne Greenberg, and The Gift of Therapy by Irvin Yalom. Happy listening.
I have been a scriptwriter for over a decade. In the past, I have suffered from creative block and been unable to write. But this time, it's so bad that I'm feeling anxious. I am so distracted. After every 15 minutes, I have the urge to check my phone, Reddit, or Twitter. I allow myself a 10-minute distraction, and then I go back to work. But these multiple social media breaks are tiring me out. It's as if I am not in control and I'm beginning to lose my confidence. I am also worried I may eventually lose work if I can't stick to my deadlines. I'm known for my ability to deliver on time and for being extremely focused, but it's all slipping away. Nobody knows how much I struggle to concentrate. The only thing that's constant is my urge to comfort myself by looking at my phone. I'm exhausted and constantly worried that it's the end of my career thanks to my dependence to the phone. Amir, 37-year-old writer. Amir's got a bad case of the itch and he's not alone. From students to startup entrepreneurs, Gen Z to baby boomers, corporate employees to homemakers, next to no one is immune to it. This behavior where we can't keep our hands off our phones or computers is what I refer to as an itch. The sense of restlessness or inability to sit still that people experience when they are without their gadgets is comparable to being itchy and scratching, or checking your device is the only way to satiate that urgent need. All of us have experienced this itch at various times and in various intensity. According to research, as a society, we are veering towards an addiction.
Welcome to Paperback by the Open Library Project. I am your co-host Satyajit, otherwise known as Onion Knight in most food circles. I'm hosting this podcast with my co-founder at the Open Library Project, Rachita Sharma Roy.
Hi guys, my name is Rachita. I'm an ex-banker, social impact entrepreneur, podcaster, writer, publisher, and inveterate learner. The Open Library Project is a curated library service which is offered to corporates on a subscription basis. The idea here is to create value, build a knowledge community, and encourage a growth mindset amongst our members.
We have as our guest today Sonali Gupta. Sonali is a clinical psychologist and the author of the book Anxiety, Overcome It and Live Without Fear. Welcome to the show, Sonali.
Thank you. Thank you, Satyajit. Thank you, Rachita.
It's great to have you on the show. I'd like to start with, so, you know, you mentioned that you've written a book on anxiety, and what was, you know, the course that got you to actually writing a book, and why did you choose the topic anxiety, which I think at this point is so, so relevant, but, you know, what was the reason for you to write a book on anxiety?
Yes, so it's surreal to have a book release. The book released on May 1st, and it's surreal to have a book release in midst of a pandemic when we all are struggling with collective anxiety. I wrote the book, though, you know, last year, you know, between Jan and August is when I wrote the book. And, you know, the book is published by HarperCollins, and my editor had reached out to me, you know, in 2018. And she had suggested the topic, you know, my editor Sonal had reached out and she suggested the topic to me.
Okay.
And one of the things, you know, after she suggested the topic that I thought about was I looked at all the work that I've done in last 16 years. And one of the things I felt was that when it comes to anxiety, from maybe 2014 to 2020, there has been a massive increase in the number of people who report symptoms of anxiety or panic attacks. And the second reason was that, you know, anxiety is an emotion where both men and women reach out for therapy often. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, my worry was, and that was one of the prime reasons for writing the book, that anxiety is very normalized. It's, you know, it's as if people think that you just deal with it and you get over it. So people don't often talk about it. And the idea of writing the book was to break this myth, you know, around the fact that everybody has to struggle with anxiety and there's no choice, and to give people a toolkit to manage their emotions.
Yeah, I think, you know, as human beings, there is a certain amount of nervousness or anxiety that everybody goes through. And I guess it's all about how you manage it and how you, you know, sort of find out those triggers which, you know, give you anxiety.
Absolutely. So, anxiety is an, you know, is an emotion that all of us experience at the end of the day. I haven't met anyone who has not experienced anxiety. At some stage, all of us have experienced anxiety.
So, Sonali, is it normal for people to feel anxious? Because, you know, of late, people have actually started speaking more about how they are affected by anxiety and how it affects their lives. So is it, has it always existed, or is it something that's a new phenomenon that's suddenly, you know, just taken over?
So, you know, anxiety as an emotion, anxiety, you know, when it's moderate to high, of, you know, therapy practice, if I look when I started in 2004, it has always existed. And even 2018, when I started, you know, writing the book, there were already people who were reporting far more number of people reaching out, you know, as I said before, for concerns related to anxiety and avoidance behavior. I think we have a greater awareness now about it. And that's why, you know, now whether it's social anxiety or anxiety, they have become terms that are part of our vocabulary now. And it's normal to experience anxiety. At the same time, you know, one of the chapters in the book is called What's Normal Anxiety and What's Not. So I think it's important to understand the duration that your symptoms of anxiety last, also the frequency and the intensity, that how severe are some of the symptoms and how long do the symptoms last, and also how debilitating is your anxiety. Is your anxiety coming in the way of your day-to-day functioning? You know, is it, you know, is it so high that, you know, you can't sleep at all? Is it so high that, you know, you have panic attacks consistently? So the important idea is to figure out when it's normal and when you need to see a qualified mental health professional.
Right. So what does anxiety, you know, kind of look like? How does it, how do we recognize that we are maybe crossing the threshold of normal anxiety into something maybe a little more dire?
Your book also mentions like physical, emotional, psychological anxiety and, you know, panic attacks and what you should do. So can you take us through that?
Yes. So, you know, anxiety is, you know, defined as this feeling where we feel restlessness or nervousness, which is about either the future or even about the task or actions which are lined up for the future. But it's also about sometimes how others are going to perceive or, you know, see us or see some of our behaviors or actions. So, you know, one of the ways physically that anxiety often manifests, and, you know, as Racheta said, the symptoms of anxiety, you know, in the book and also otherwise are covered in the context of physical, emotional, behavioral and cognitively. So physically, a sign of anxiety could be difficulty breathing, sweaty palms, tightness in the chest, shortness of breath, stomach ache, sweating excessively. Some of the emotional signs of anxiety could be a sense of, you know, apprehension, a feeling of, you know, a feeling of doubt, a consistent feeling that, you know, of fogginess in your head, and sometimes even feeling too alert and hyper-cautious. So those are the emotional symptoms. And the behavioral ways that anxiety manifested, it manifests in this urge to avoid tasks. You know, so people would often say that, you know, I'm invited to so many parties, but, you know, on some days I just feel so uncertain, so anxious that I end up canceling them, right? So, you know, so the tendency to avoid social situations or, you know, behaviors where one is canceling things, not because one is sick, but one is emotionally feeling uncertain and emotionally feeling overwhelmed. So that's one of the behavioral ways that, you know, So one is struggling in that sense, and that anxiety is very real. Also, cognitively, cognitively we mean in the context of thought. So it may come up in the form of overthinking, rumination, feeling that constantly there are thoughts in your head and you're in this thought spiral and you can't get yourself out. Also, with the people, when they are anxious, they consistently have this fear that something will go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And when these, we all have experienced that tightness in the chest maybe once in a while, or, like before an examination, before a speech, kind of feel the butterflies in the stomach. Now, once in a while is absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. When it comes to this point where you're experiencing it most of the day, or when you're experiencing the symptoms are throughout the day and they last for long durations, they also happen almost every second day. And, let's say you miss going to work because there's a presentation that's making you anxious. Mm-hmm. And those are signs that anxiety is very high. Or let's say you have a flight to take. Of course, in a pandemic, I can imagine taking a flight would trigger anxiety.
Yeah.
But in a pre-pandemic world, if you have a flight to take and for a week at a stretch, you have not had sleep. You have consistently worried that you will lose, what if you don't reach the airport on time? What if you forget your passport? Then there are signs of anxiety which may be on the higher side.
Right. So I wanted to actually ask you a question.
Yes.
You mentioned the pandemic, and I have realized that, through this pandemic, definitely my anxiety levels have gone up. So, and I feel like the main trigger for that is uncertainty, because we're not sure of what's happening. You're not sure of, what's going to happen in the next 10 days. And when you hear like someone you know who's got COVID, sometimes I felt like, I have shortness of breath because I'm so anxious about, a close loved one having COVID or something like that. So it's a sort of a, panic attack, I would guess. But what do you think you should do at such a point to sort of manage this kind of stress that all of us, I believe, must be going through?
So yes, this is, as I said in the beginning, this is a period of collective anxiety. I think with the pandemic, I don't know if you experienced what you experienced is a panic attack. Mm. If it is a panic attack and if it's consistent, the feelings keep coming, then it's a good idea to see a mental health professional.
Mm.
At the same time, if the anxiety is about the uncertainty,
yeah.
I think it's important to remember that uncertainty by itself is a neutral term. I say this in the book. So the book was edited when in the midst of a pandemic.
Okay.
So one of the things that I've written in the book is that just because we don't know what's going to happen next few months from now, doesn't mean that things may not go right. It just means that we just don't know what's going to happen.
That's right. And also I think, not being able to see someone who's in the hospital makes you feel very helpless, and it's all
absolutely
of that adds to it.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it may be important to reimagine uncertainty and see it as a neutral term rather than a negative term. I think in times like pandemic, what's happening is a lot of people are catastrophizing. In the book, I speak about it in detail. But what I mean by catastrophizing is people are thinking about the worst case scenario. So you could look at a COVID tracker, you could look at the paper, and the first thought in your mind would be that, what if, it happens to me? What if I fall sick or my family member falls sick?
Yeah.
We are already moving to the worst case scenario. And because we are already moving to a worst case scenario, we are feeling anxious. The reality is that it is not happening to us now. And maybe a lot of people from March to now have catastrophized thousands of times.
Yeah.
So in fact, one of the things I say in the book is that in my eyes, personally, I feel the opposite of anxiety is mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
So the degree to which we can stay present, stay in the present, and of course, take all necessary precaution, is the degree that we can take care of ourselves. So learning to be mindful and telling ourselves, this is not happening to me. I am catastrophizing is one of the ways to deal with that overwhelming anxiety.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. That's such good advice. What you said about uncertainty is so point on, is so bang on point, because you know, we tend to just go directly to worst case scenarios when the truth is it probably may not even ever happen to us, right?
Yeah, so, thank you.
And it's a great way to look at uncertainty, is that, you know, don't look at it as the worst case. Uncertainty is, could be the best case also, right? So that's fantastic. It could go both ways. Yeah. And earlier on, you mentioned that in 2000, you've seen a rise in anxiety cases drastically since 2014. And yes, I think 2014 was the year in which 100 million Android phones were sold in India. So that everyone got a mobile phone in their hands. And like you mentioned in the excerpt which you read, social media is plays a part in our anxiety. And given the times that we live in, we do have a tendency to kind of keep checking our phone. And that also causes different sorts of anxiety. So can you tell us a little bit about how we can deal with the current times where social media is such a big part of our lives?
Yes, I think, you know, and by you know, 2014, even my, you know, what I've understood is that the rise in technology, we having so much free access to information, social media has contributed to anxiety. And, you know, I mention it throughout the book that I don't think we have a choice about whether to do technology or not. You know, it's about how do we manage technology and how do we use it to our advantage. Right. Like, we couldn't be doing, in the midst of a pandemic, we wouldn't have been able to do this call if not for technology.
Yes.
So, you know, one cannot do away with it. One just needs to figure out ways to navigate it. I think one of the first things is to, you know, examine how, you know, how social media in turn controls you. Are you controlling your behavior, or is social media something which is, you know, controlling your behavior? And I think what is important, you know, what I talk about in the book is about that people need to set some digital boundaries. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the phone, when it comes to social media, it's very important to examine what's your relationship with social media. How often are you checking the information? How often are you on your phone? So, you know, I mentioned in the book sometimes, and I ask clients in therapy to maintain a log of, you know, their phone usage. Mm-hmm. And I had clients who have used their phone for 12 to 16 hours.
Wow. Mm.
So, and I'm assuming with the pandemic, that 12 to 16 hours would be valid to a lot of people.
Yeah.
When all the work is also happening only with technology at the end of the day.
Okay.
I think the second thing is that what social media does is, you know, the book talks about, you know, the dopamine loop. You know, and by dopamine loop, what I mean is that we are all so addicted to the likes, the notifications, mm-hmm. the shares, reshares. There's consist, you know, it's really like we are walking with a dopamine drip attached to us. You know, we constantly want those rewards given to us. And my worry is that our self-esteem is being attached to it.
Right.
And lastly, I think what has happened is that for the longest time now, maybe a lot of people have normalized some of these processes, and, you know, and we are confusing what we are seeing on social media as reality. So there's a segment that I talk about called death by social comparison. So I think one of the biggest stressors, even during the pandemic and otherwise, is like social media is like literally death by comparison, you know, by social comparison. Oh, how many followers this one has? Oh, who is verified, who's not verified?
Yes.
And then, oh, how many holidays has someone done? Oh, during the pandemic, you know, A is learning so many new recipes. I haven't learned any new recipe. And I think all these are massive problematic lenses at the end of the day.
And it's always the best case scenario that, you know, you can...
Yes.
It's not like people are putting up, you know, difficult times that they're going through. It's more about, you know, just a good bit which you get to see. So that, I guess, makes people more lonely and, you know, makes them feel more anxious.
Absolutely. You know, and one of the things I mentioned in the book is like we are confusing people's curated lenses. These are people's best case curated lenses based on moments. Somebody would have posted a picture of this massive dish that they cooked. and not told you that they had a fight with their partner just before they posted the picture, or that the kitchen is really messy after this massive dish.
Yeah.
But you just see that picture and you're like, wow, you know, like someone was telling me when initially in March people were posting pictures. I remember, you know, even I looked at some pictures and I was like, in my area, there are not even burger buns available. How can you be making your burger? You know, like I don't even have bread for 2 weeks. So, you know, so at every given time, there is also that comparison when we see these pictures, and it's important to learn to be mindful that these are best, these are curated versions of people's lives.
Yeah. I think we tend to compare our regular lives with the best version of people's lives, and that's where we kind of fall short in our own
mind. Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And we all are guilty of doing that.
Yeah. So can you tell us a few tips how we can manage this sort of, because it's kind of subconscious, right? We're not even consciously doing it. So is there some tips to kind of pull back from this behavior, or like, you know, manage it better?
Yes. So, you know, I think it is important. The first step is the awareness around it, to even recognize that you're falling in for these behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the second important bit is to recognize what are some of what are some of the beliefs you have around it that may be controlling your behavior. So sometimes our beliefs could be everybody has a good life other than me,
right?
Or everybody is being productive, I'm not being productive.
Yeah.
So I think it's most important that people work through those irrational beliefs, because you don't know who is being productive, right? Like social media is never a lens of what's happening in people's life in their houses.
Yeah.
Right.
It's just a snapshot.
Yeah, yes. It's like cinema, you know. You see the best version of stars where they look their best and they, you know, perform their best and everything is hunky-dory. So I guess, yeah. It's,
yeah, and people are not sum total of their social media life. They're far
yeah.
You know, I think it's a common myth to just confuse people as sum total of their social media life.
True. And can you tell us some ways of how you know, we can be compassionate to ourselves?
Yes, you know, as a therapist, I primarily use a compassion-based approach to therapy. So, you know, and I feel of all things, you know, the book is written with that lens. And I think the first step is that if you are struggling with anxiety, it's never too late to, you know, work on it. And I think that's the beginning of compassion. And, you know, this is my favorite example, I think. So one of my clients was 78 when she started therapy.
Okay.
And it's been 2 years in therapy, a little over 2 years. And I've been amazed by the fact that, you know, at 80 years to make such significant changes and learn to manage one's own emotion, I think that says a lot about the person. And I think it says a lot about the human brain. So, you know, when every time people tell me that, listen, I've wasted my life, I should have come to you much before, or, you know, I've not achieved anything, I often tell them that it's never too late. You know, if someone at 80 can still learn to manage their anxiety and, you know, regulate their mood, it's possible for everyone. And I think the second bit is to recognize what does our critical voice look like, because I think whether it's productivity guilt, whether it's imposter syndrome, I think it's important for all of us to recognize when, you know, we are struggling with it and we use these shoulds and musts that we impose on ourselves. Technically, those shoulds and musts don't, you know, they cannot work at the end of the day. One needs to give oneself some flexibility at least.
Yeah, I think you have to be a little okay with making mistakes and okay with not being perfect.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's only when you make mistakes, you learn to navigate the world. So you have to give yourself the choice to make those mistakes and learn from it. And a huge part of the book is also about people who have struggled with it. The book uses a lot of case studies, you know, from last 16 years that I've had, and how have they managed to deal with their anxiety. And so, you know, I think the idea is that people need to build, they need to develop that lens for themselves. Most of the time, as I mentioned in the book, people are more kind to others, but they are less kind to themselves.
And, you know, I feel, Sonali, that there is a lot of stigma attached to the fact that somebody wants to go take, you know, medical help for it. And it becomes more like, oh, there's something wrong with your brain. And people make you feel that, you know, you're probably crazy. That's why you're feeling these things. And that's why people who are really suffering don't actually go to, you know, take that help which they need. So although I think like over the years, it has gotten better and people are being more, you know, open to visiting a therapist. But so, you know, how do you approach this? Like, how are you supposed to convince somebody who is feeling, you know, anxious that this is just like treating a cold by going to a doctor and that's about it?
So, you know, as a therapist, you know, as a psychologist, I only do therapy sessions. So there is no medication involved there. And in the book, there is an entire segment on how do you learn to be a caregiver to somebody who struggles with anxiety. So, you know, I'm going to say a couple of points from there. The first one is about that it may be important for you to recognize that what does anxiety look like and what does it feel like, you know, to know what are the symptoms of anxiety. So when others are struggling with it, you don't really trivialize it for the other person. That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is that I know often, you know, the analogy that is used to a medical illness. The only difference is that when it comes to mental health concerns, they may take longer and there may not be that one solution, one medicine that fits all. So I think as a caregiver, it's very important to be patient about it and to know that, you know, that somebody who's struggling will come to their own readiness to work around it. So what you could possibly do is recognize the symptom, you know, don't trivialize the symptom for sure. And fourth, offer them support in ways, you know, where you maybe give them the number of psychologists, psychiatrists who they can reach out to, tell them that possibly you can accompany them to one of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and be present, you know, be emotionally present and say, I'm around if you, you know, would want to talk. And don't be judgmental because, you know, mental health concerns, you know, anxiety specifically in the book and even other concerns, they take time for us to deal with them.
Right. I mean,
after Sushant Singh Rajput's, you know, suicide, it was
really like, shocking to know because this is what you feel, right? Like they have the perfect life and everything is perfect and you don't, you know, the person is smiling, you can't even realize or recognize that there's something wrong and then they take such a step. So that's very, you know, disheartening.
Absolutely. And I think whether, you know, we don't know what happened exactly, you know, in Sushant Singh's case, at the same time, a lot of illnesses, including anxiety, they are invisible. So with mental health concerns, often, like my clients would often tell me, you know, while they don't see each other, each session is 20 minutes apart, they would say if they ever bumped into one, that nobody really looks like they are struggling with anything. Because it's not that it's written on people's faces what they are struggling with.
Right.
So often it's hard for us to identify. And that's why we need greater compassion and greater sensitivity.
Great. So, Sonali, where can we find your book? Where is it available?
So, yes. So, the book is available on paperback now on Amazon. And the book is available on Kindle too, all over the world. So, the book is available on both.
Fantastic.
On Kindle and paperback, yes.
And on that note, we are going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll be discussing a few more books with Sonali. Welcome back, guys. We still have with us Sonali Gupta, author of the book Anxiety. Hey, Sonali, that was a very informational first half, especially
Thank
given
you.
The pandemic. I think everyone needs these tips to kind of stay focused on, you know, being running their regular lives rather than dealing with anxiety all the time. So fantastic. And I think all our listeners would be very happy to take these tips in.
Thank you.
So
I hope it helps them.
I'm sure they'll be helped. So the next book that we're moving on to is The Gift of Therapy. So tell us a little bit about this book, Sonali. How did you come by it, and what about this book stands out for you?
So, you know, this book is by psychiatrist, you know, Irvin Yalom. And, you know, I think early in my, you know, career, you know, like maybe I think 3 to 5 years into my career is when I read this book. Mm-hmm. I think this book, you know, I particularly like because it's very simply written. And for anybody who's interested in mental health and therapy, what it looks like, the book, you know, has small chapters which talks about, you know, the insights that therapists have. Like in one of the chapters, he talks about hit the iron when it's cold. So, okay. You know, that's the crux of the chapter, which basically means that it's important even when one works with clients in therapy that you discuss a difficult emotion when their emotions are, when the client has worked on an emotion and they are feeling far more stable. They will take your feedback really well. So, you know, the book has a lot of pearls of wisdom in very simple language. Mm-hmm. And even if you're not a therapist, there are so many things you will learn from the book in the context of understanding yourself. So if any of your readers also wonder what do they want to start with if they want to understand therapy, this is one of the very good books, very simply written and also a compassionate, very non-judgmental perspective on human behavior. And also almost a lens into how therapists think.
Awesome. So the next book that we're going to be talking about is In the Company of Men. So yes. Tell us a little bit about this book as well.
You know, this is one of those books, I think, that has pretty much shaped a large part of my career.
Okay.
And I feel this is one of those books which should have done really well. I don't know how well did the book do. But, you know, when I was about 19, 20, I read the book. So, you know, like a good... So that's like a good, like now 18 years back, you know, 17, 18 years back when I read this book. This book talks about therapy and mental health from the eyes of how men would perceive it and how do you work with emotions when it particularly comes to men in the context of individual and group work. And I feel even, you know, although this book was written so many years back, I still feel there's a massive dearth of literature when it comes to therapy and how both genders respond to therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And for me personally, I feel because I read it at 19, 20, one of those years, you know, while I was still studying, it helped me form a lot of narratives and an understanding and a narrative of compassion and sensitivity towards both genders. So it allowed me to have a lot, it provided me templates in that. You know, like the book makes very good distinction about the difference between anger and rage. Like, you know, very often we confuse rage as anger. We feel that acute anger is rage, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the book talks about how rage is this emotion of powerlessness and actually helplessness that we feel. You know, when we are feeling rage, that is what we are feeling. And it talks about the book is again filled with a lot of case examples. The book is filled with actual cases. And of course, you know, all of us as therapists, when we write their composite cases, you change all, you know, all characteristics, but still. And I think this book pretty much, you know, when I was 19, 20 also inspired the way I work with people. And I think even in my writing style, when I've used a lot of case studies throughout every chapter, they're like about 4 to 5 case studies or more some places. I think this book, you know, it kind of provided me that template. And it's again one of those very few books which are simply written. Even if you are not a therapist, you would still understand all of it. So I think it's perfect for anyone who's looking to read it and to even understand mental health from a gender narrative. And I think it is very, very important. And this is compassionate and done very beautifully.
Yeah, I also feel like, you know, men are not very expressive because, you know, they are always told to be strong and not cry and not emote. So it'll probably be useful for them to, you know, read this book because it'll give the book perspective to it.
Yes, the book covers all of these. I feel, in fact, that both men and women need to read it because it's important to look, you know, sometimes for even women to understand and for men, I think both, this is the gender-based literature is that both of them should expose, you know, one should read it even, you know, as a woman and even as a man. For a lot of men, there will be identification. And for a lot of other people, you know, women, it will provide them also a lens from making sense of how, as from a gender perspective, sometimes we navigate the world so differently.
Absolutely.
Great. And the last book we're going to be talking about is I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. So tell us a little bit about this book, Sunam.
Yes. So I read this book when I was about 17, 18, again, okay. So many years back. And, you know, it's also a film as of now, you know, it's also a film that exists, you know, that came out some years later.
Mm-hmm.
This book is about this girl who goes to, you know, one of these, I don't think it's asylums, but it's one of those centers where people who are struggling with severe mental health concerns are taken care of and are provided therapy, medication. I think they do portray it like an, you know, like a sort of asylum. I don't know what's the term exactly that the book uses.
Mm-hmm.
But the book is based on the premise where the therapist is telling the person, you know, who's struggling with mental health concerns here is. And these are severe mental health concerns, including hallucinations, you know, delusions. She says that even when you work with me and you get better and you go back to the world, I'm not, you know, there is no promise of a rose garden out there. You know, I never promised you. So even when people work in therapy and they go out there,
mm-hmm.
one of my biggest learning was that things never completely get better. There right. are, even if you work in therapy, there are still going to be challenges. All yeah. you can work with your clients is to teach them how to take care of themselves, and using a similar analogy, to be realistic that life will keep throwing challenges at us again and again. And, you know, just as we were talking in the podcast, the uncertainty will always be there.
Yeah.
Even when clients leave therapy, I come from a belief and I feel that it's important for them at some stage to, you know, even when they leave therapy, to know that there will be challenges, they will have better coping skills to manage what they are struggling with. And, you know, and that's the realistic bit we can have. And I think I love the, you know, I love that book particularly because it allowed me to be very realistic very early on in life about how much you can do as a therapist. Because there's no magic wand. There are no magic. There are no solutions. There are no instant complete solutions. Therapy is a slow process. And it's just that, you know, it's that clients learn to trust themselves. And I think that's a big process in itself.
Great. So, Sunali, where can people reach out to you online? Are you on social media in case they want
yes,
to reach out?
Yeah. Absolutely. So on social media, if they were to reach out on Instagram, it's Mental Health with Sunali. That's
mm-hmm.
my handle.
Okay.
And YouTube is also Mental Health, you know, with Sunali. There are videos around mental health if anybody wants to see. On Twitter, it is Gupta Sunali. So they can reach out to me on any of these.
Fantastic. And what a great selection of books. Because I think all these books, if you read them, they give you an insight into yourself and how you should be dealing with things. So thank you for the recommendations. I'm sure our listeners will be obliged. And
thank you for hosting me. Speaking to both of you.
It was great having you on the show. And I feel that we, both of us, have also benefited from this conversation just in the terms of, you know, how we should be dealing with things. And I hope our listeners will take that away as well. So thank you so much.
That's lovely to hear. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being on the show. And we hope to have you again, maybe when your next book is out.
Thank you for so much faith. Yes, I hope I can write. I hope I can, yeah, write another one, you know, sometime in the future. Yes.
Great.
Big thank you to all our listeners. You can follow the Open Library Project on LinkedIn, Instagram, and Facebook for latest updates on our events. And stay tuned for the next paperback podcast on IVM Podcasts. Happy reading. You can follow IVM Podcasts on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at IVM Podcasts. Listen to paperback on the IVM Podcast app, website, or wherever you listen to podcasts.